Hi everyone, welcome back. Thanks as always for tuning in. Podchat Live, episode 112. Recording this 6th of February 2024. I'm here as always with my co-host Craig. How are you, Craig?
Yeah, no, I'm really good. Looking forward to a hard gym workout today. I'm still a bit scared to go above 5K with the running because of my breakdown point is getting pretty near. So we'll see how it goes.
Good. I am glad you are so well. We as we've always or as we keep repeating, we love bringing kind of hot off the press research and I think when we first brought back this new format, certainly I don't know about you, Craig, but I was a little bit worried when we sort of committed to, doing the week in podiatry. I was worried there wouldn't be enough to talk about, and quite the opposite. We're struggling to choose the things we want to talk about. So there's three papers all published in the last week that we're going to try and get through today because we think they're quite interesting. And we didn't really see anything that was more interesting than that in the mainstream media or news. So I think without further ado, we'll just crack straight on and signpost them as we do, and then and talk through them and summarize them and get Craig's thoughts as well. So first up, super mindful that I'm and nervous here that I'm outside of my comfort zone when I talk about papers from the dermatology realm, but we do know from our days of Podchat Live, our dermatology episodes were always up there with our most popular. So when we saw this was published, we thought we'd better give it a mention. So it was published on Wednesday last week, and we record these on Tuesday night, so it didn't quite make last week. So it was just about 6 days old, and it's from a group of researchers in Spain, and it's been published in the Journal of Medical Virology, and it's open access. It is called Strengthening the Relationship Between Intractable Plantar Keratosis and the Human Papillomavirus. So I think in lay terms, I hope I'm not mistranslating this, that is sort of big lumps of callus and verrucas. Is that a fair layperson's summary, Craig?
Yeah, look, I think this term intractable plantar keratosis has largely been a North American term. It's starting to spread a bit more widely now. But yeah, it's a plantar corn, perhaps with perhaps a bit of fibrous elements in there. I think we all know what it is when we see it. We just might want to call it something different.
Absolutely. Been a while since I've seen one, I must confess as well. But yeah, I would imagine if you're looking at, big lumps of keratosis on the foot, your immediate assumption that it is not a verruca may be challenged when you look at the results of this paper. So I'll try not to butcher it, and I'll in my lack of understanding of it, but they took 51 patients with IPK, which we're going to call it now, intractable plantar keratosis. They took some punch biopsies, as I understand. First one was sent for histopathological examination, and nearly 70% of them were reported as being warts when they thought they were just lumps of callus. Second punch biopsy and a superficial skin scraping were then sent for something called HPV polymerase chain reaction, PCR, and type determination. I don't know what that means, but I'm sure the podiatric dermatologists amongst the listeners do. And they found that the presence of human papillomavirus was confirmed in 96% and 82% of samples obtained by punch and superficial scraping, respectively. So the conclusion here, just to try and put a bow on this, is that the study was highlighting that viral tissue, HPV infection, and IPK lesions are very closely related. Now, they were quite clear that they weren't suggesting HPV was the cause of the development of IPK, but high prevalence of HPV observed in these lesions calls for a change to the procedures for managing IPK. Lot of abbreviations there, Craig. How do we summarize this for the listeners?
Well, I think it's not odd. I think it's quite
Do you think this will be
quite
a surprise to people?
eye-opening.
It won't be a
Yeah.
surprise to people.
Look, no, I think it's somewhat eye-opening. I think there has been speculation in the past, and it's pure speculation of the role of viruses in the hyperkeratosis and things like this. And I mean, firstly, this is just a correlation. They just found, most of these IPKs had the HPV virus, and we can only speculate of what role that may play in the pathogenesis. We've always, these are pressure lesions. These are caused by too much pressure on an area over a long period of time. No role for a virus whatsoever. Yet this found viruses in all of them. So again, I think this is of huge interest, huge speculation of the mechanism, and certainly watch this space. I'm not sure the fact that they had the virus, these were actually Verrucas and not IPKs. I think we can speculate that. There is a high, clinically there's a lot of misdiagnosis that does go on. So I think this is extraordinarily intriguing, as to where it goes from here. And obviously this is open access, so you can look at, but scroll down to look at the first photo. This is podiatrist bread and butter. This is your standard planter HK, but a callus with a nucleus, which is the corn in the middle. And this is what we do. Yet they've found a virus in most of them. So yeah, let's just see where this heads.
Yeah, I have absolutely nothing to add that will be of value or substance, so I'm going to move on.
Yeah, actually, I will add one more thing, not specifically this paper, but did you notice the authors are from Spain? And
Yes.
I don't think you noticed in the last 6 months how much good research and good relevant research has been published from Spain.
Spanish
Not, not,
podiatrists are very, very, very smart group,
yeah.
aren't they?
But it's been in the last 6 months. It's really been quite an influx. And these are from podiatry schools. This one's obviously not podiatry; it's from a medical school. But there really has been an upsurge in the last 6 months, and some of it most interesting as well.
Well, it's almost as if planned, our next paper is also from a group of researchers in Spain. And it's also semi-dermatological, you could argue, but it's sort of speaking a bit more to our biases, and a bit biomechanical as well. So this was published yesterday, 5th of February 2024, open access in BMC musculoskeletal disorders. There'll be a link to it as always. The title is Cross-Sectional Study of the Prevalence of Hyperextension of the First Metatarsophalangeal Joint and its Relationship to Onycholysis in Women with Hallux Valgus. So they've taken bunions and a sort of biomechanical measurement, and they've looked at sort of its relationship, potential relationship with a nail pathology, onycholysis, which I'm sure most of you know, but just in case, I know we do have some students listening. Essentially, that is a separate, my lay description of it would be a separation of the nail plate from the nail bed. So what they did in this study was they took 129 females, but they reported a total of 248 hallux valguses. So, I think it's almost all of them had it bilaterally, I think is what you take from those numbers. They measured their first metatarsophalangeal joint, big toe joint extension. That was measured with a goniometer. They classified the severity of the hallux valgus, the bunion, and this was determined by the Manchester Visual Scale. They used a digital meter to look at the height of the first toe in the standing position. A bit difficult to visualize what that is, but there's a good picture of it in the article, and it is open access, so go and check it out. And then they performed a clinical examination where they could allow them to collect information on the presence of onycholysis of that toenail as well. So lots of things to pull out of this, but ultimately, of the 248 bunions, 40% had onycholysis. So, just under half. I'll cut to the chase and the conclusion they made. When they looked at the correlations between all of the measures and data they collected, the incidence of onycholysis appears to be significantly associated with hallux valgus, which shows more than 30 degrees extension and more than 2 centimeter height of the first toe. So they're essentially saying, if you've got a bunion and a couple of other features, biomechanical features, it appears that there's a greater likelihood that you'll have onycholysis. And they also went on to claim that the height and hyperextension of the big toe, together with first toenail pathology, should be mandatory in the evaluation of hallux valgus. That's quite an interesting take home for me, Craig.
Yeah, no, I think that was the take home for me, was that height of the hallux measurement. And they've got a, if you look at the full text, they've got a really neat little tool for measuring the height of the helix.
I'll be
But
honest,
it
I'd not seen, had you seen that before? I'd never seen
no,
that
didn't like
particular
that.
measure
Yeah.
before.
No, never. But I do know, like we toenail pathology, you always check for the hyperextension of the helix. But I just checked their references, and assuming they did a pretty good review of the literature, it's never been quantified before. So this is the first time we've sort of had some sort of quantification of that hyperextension, or is, well, as they call it, the height of the helix, which could be due to other things than helix hyperextension. Yeah, but everything about the study makes sense. I think it's something hopefully most people are checking clinically in nail pathologies, but now it's been quantified.
What do you
Which,
think? What do you think would have happened if they had a group of individuals who did not have hallux valgus, but also had
well,
those other features, that height of the hallux and the more than 30 degrees extension? Do you think? How, I guess what I'm asking here is, how much of this do you think was the hallux valgus, and how much do you think were the other features?
look, I don't know, and that is a very, say, perhaps minor weakness of the study, is they didn't include a non-hallux valgus group, but I don't think we can hold that against them. But it would be interesting to pursue that, because you'd think the height of the helix or the helix hyperextension is the risk factor. With helix valgus, you're going to get some rotation of the helix, so the pressure from the shoe is going to be on a different part of the nail plate. So whether that's the factor in onycholysis or not, that's going to need to be explored. But yeah, it could potentially be a slightly different result because of the rotation of the helix you see in helix valgus. I don't know, but I do like this height of the helix measurement or parameter.
It was a totally new one on me. I'd love to hear from people who are listening, if they dive into the open access paper, see the image, and tell us if it's something they've seen before or they utilize. I don't think it necessarily would be utilized clinically, but I'd not even seen that measuring tool before. I might have to jump on Amazon and buy myself one just to play around with a little bit.
Oh yeah. Oh no,
So
look, it's just, it's, I mean, what would be neat? Can we measure the height of the helix? Can we measure the height of the toe box in the shoe? And can we match them up?
yeah,
Good
absolutely.
practical outcome.
So we'll move on to our third paper. So we started with dermatology, we then morphed into sort of a dermatology slash biomechanics, and now we're going to move into full biomechanics. So a lovely sort of move across the topics. And this was a paper that was published 2 days ago, so 4th of February 2024. It was published in Sports Health Journal, and it's from a team of researchers in Iran, and it is titled "Predictors of Running Related Injury Among Recreational Runners: A Prospective Cohort Study of the Role of Perfectionism, Mental Toughness, and Passion in Running." Now, sadly, this one is not open access, but if you want to read it and you want a copy, then message us and we will email you a copy. Because of two things. Firstly, it's that classic topic that we all love. What are the predictors of running related injury? We're going around that bush yet again. And secondly, it isn't, I think we've mentioned this on a previous episode, Craig. Historically, when we looked at research that was looking at, risk factors for running injury, they were all, architectural or biomechanical. And now we're getting much more psychosocial stuff, which I know we're both into. So just to briefly summarize what they did and what they found. 143 runners. Possible limitation for me, I don't know how you feel about this. I'll ask you in a minute, Craig, but all of the data here collected by the runners via them filling out an online questionnaire themselves. So they filled out a questionnaire about their characteristics, about their running behaviors, about psychological variables such as perfectionism, mental toughness, and running passion. And they also filled out the data about sport, about injury, and also they were asked about their own foot posture as well. So it's really worth bearing that in mind when we talk about what the findings were. Then they followed them through a period of 6 months, and running related injuries were recorded bi-weekly. Now, I scanned the paper this morning when you sent it to me. I always want to look for what the definition of running injury was used here. I think that's something important to identify as well. Incidence of injuries then expressed as running related injury per 1,000 hours. They found, by the way, that on average, 5 injuries per 1,000 hours of running. And then they looked at the association between some of the potentially predictive factors and running related injuries and used kind of some logistic regression, etc. So things they found and things that probably speak to previous research and fit our own biases. Most injured location, the knee, closely followed by the foot. I certainly think that echoes previous work. Love this one. A higher obsessive passion for running. I love the term obsessive passion, but a higher obsessive passion and perfectionistic concerns were associated with a greater risk of running related injuries. Now, I know we've got some previous data about personality types, type A personalities being more likely to get injured in running. So I think that fits as well. Weekly distance run was a risk factor for injury, and previous injury was a risk factor for injury. So all of those feel really in keeping with our current understanding. Here's the one I'm not sure about when it comes to foot types. Supinated foot types and pronated foot types were a risk for injury. Now, a couple of things here. Remember, participants reported their own foot type. But secondly, if they're both risk factors for injury, isn't that the same as foot type not being a risk factor for injury? I guess it's a reporting thing, isn't it? Is the glass half full or is the glass half empty? And lastly, something that was shown to lower the risk of running injury was following a running schedule. So some real kind of nice data there. Craig, thoughts?
Well, just on that issue of foot posture, you know, we know what the literature says on that, and that's obviously mixed. But we know from several other studies, most runners get it wrong when they're asked about what their foot type is. So in this particular study, they was actually sent arch imprints of different arch heights and asked to classify their arch height based on what they were sent or given to compare it to. So it was really based on a perhaps the wet footprint test or something along those lines, which, yeah. So look, so I'm cautious about that data. I would assume if you asked a large group of runners about their foot type, they'll either say they're pronated or supinated. Very few would say they were neither. Let's just say the key finding that a previous injury was a risk factor, that the one again that comes through in every study, but it also intrigues me as to why it is a risk factor. So if you have a, and there are several explanations there, and the problem is I don't think we know which explanation is the correct one. You have the, are they getting another injury because they have all the risk factors? That's why they got the first one. Or did they get inadequate rehab of the first one, and that's why they've got an injury? Or are their tissues weak from the previous injury, and that's why they've got another injury? So it could be any one of those three. So I don't think that's ever been resolved yet. But I think the key, the exciting one here for me was this obsessive passion and perfectionistic concerns. And I had to Google those to find out what they were. I'm assuming that the tools that they used, and that's a little disappointed that I couldn't find the tool they actually used to measure that. It's obviously in the psychology literature, but those more passionate, more likely to get an injury. Those more perfectionist, more likely to get an injury, which kind of makes sense. And I think that if you've treated enough athletes over the years, you get a feel for that. You know, we all have a conversation about our patients about. Actually, here's an example. I've just had a recent patient in who's about to do the Oxfam Trail Walk, which is a 24-hour thing. And you know, oh yeah, have you done it before? Yeah, what do you think of it? And all this, you have these conversations with them, and I think subconsciously we're measuring how obsessive, passionate they are about their sport. I think we're trying to get a feel for how perfectionist they are about their sport because that will affect our recommendations and advice regarding the rehab and the treatment. So I think we're sort of doing it, or we sort of should be doing it. It's kind of nice to have a name for it now, and it's kind of nice to have a potential tool to measure or assess it.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think when we take a history, there's such depth and richness to taking a history. And sometimes you ask a question as simple as what do you do for a living? And you can get so much information from it. You know, some of us are asking people for small talk, some of us want to get a feel for how much time that person's spending sitting. Or you sometimes get an answer which will hint at this person is probably a perfectionist. So yeah, it can speak to their personality type. So yeah, it's funny, it's Tuesday night. I've been in clinic 2 days this week, all day Monday, and then the first half of today, and I've seen at least five type A personalities, very analytical. I'd probably now refer to them as high obsessive passion, perfectionistic, concerns. I've seen them with knee problems. I've seen them with high weekly running distances. And I just look at this, and it just sounds, anyone that works in a city, well, it doesn't have to be London, anyone that works in a city near people that work in law or finance, this will speak to them and go, yeah, I see people who are type A personalities who are, doing high mileage. And like I say, the foot posture thing is the thing I take the least from this, but everything else just really, really fits my bias. It really speaks to my clinical practice.
Yeah, well, it's like that onycholysis thing. It's not. It's something we sort of should have known, but it's nice to have a tool.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, that's the great thing about research. It doesn't always have to be, it doesn't always have to be mind-blowingly new and hot, practice changing. Sometimes it can just kind of speak to what you think, already. Confirmation bias, I think we call it. But we're all comfortable when we read something that we already do. So three papers just hit the 21-minute mark, which, as you know, when I get to 21 minutes, I like to try and wrap things up. So I'm delighted with that. My usual shout out: we have not hit 50 ratings on Apple or Spotify yet. We are creeping up on both of them. We are up to 25 on Apple and 45 on Spotify. So we're nearly at the magic 50 on Spotify. We've had a couple more reviews posted, really kind words posted on Apple as well. Thank you for those. Please do rate us, review us, like, share, all that, subscribe, all that kind of stuff. And of course, follow us on social media, email us if you've got any questions, queries, things you want us to discuss, or if you want that paper that we've just referred to, get involved at podchatlive.com. We will be back next week, roughly the same time, talking about what's been happening in podiatry in the next 7 days.
Great. Thanks a lot, Ian. We'll see everyone next week.
Take care, mate.